Call the meeting to order of July 7th. Ask you to rise and pledge allegiance to the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Could we have a roll call of members, please?
Yes. Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Cha?
I'm here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Mr. Hattery?
Here.
Ms. Herrera?
Here.
Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Ms. McAsee?
Here.
Mrs. McBean, Dearborn, will be a few minutes late this evening. Mr. Proto?
Here.
Mr. Randall has asked to be excused. Ms. Robertson?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Here.
Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Mr. Stevenson has also asked to be excused. Mr. Kalinka-Lair?
Present.
With 12 members present.
Petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
We have no special orders of the day, so we'll move to approval to the floor for the public. Remind you that you have 3 minutes each. We're going to try to move things along because one of our municipal officials who wants to speak has to try to get to a 6 p.m. meeting, so I may have to interrupt someone to let him speak so we can move on. I have a number of people who signed up in advance to speak. First, I have William Tyler from Dryden. Bill?
Hey,
you can step up to the mic. If you use the mic there, that'd be...
Yeah, I'm Dr. Bill Tyler. I'm a retired physician. Practiced in Tompkins County for 24 years in New Jersey and Massachusetts before that. And I'm rising to speak in favor of resolution number H regarding single-payer health insurance. I'm doing this even though I was in private practice for many years because I feel the current system is broken and not repairable. I feel that medical insurance or medical care insurance cannot be equated with automobile accident insurance or home insurance. Any of us can do without the luxury of driving a car. None of us can do without the luxury or do without health insurance or health care. Furthermore, the cost of the current system continues to rise exponentially, and there's been no evidence that so that the competitive mode so useful in America has managed to control its cost in any way. Therefore, I feel very strongly that our federal government should become a national health insurer. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Next, we have Mike Lane. After Mike, we will have Bernie Flattery.
I would certainly associate myself with Dr. Tyler's remarks. But what I came this evening to talk about, again, is the nonsense we're seeing at the State Senate, New York State Senate. For weeks now, we've had gridlock up there, which has been hurting Tompkins County and the other counties in our state by denying the kinds of legislation that needs to, to happen for continuation of the business that, at hand, including the sales tax extension for Tompkins County. It's bad enough that the county has to go begging every 2 years to have the extension renewed, but for it to be stuck in this kind of a gridlock nonsense that we've been watching, where the senators are up there playing games, running two separate meetings, trying to make a quorum for somebody walking through the aisle with for a cup of coffee. They should act like adults. They should go ahead and come up with some kind of a power-sharing agreement and go forward with that. Tompkins County is represented by three New York State senators, Jim Seward, Mike Nozzolio, and George Winner. depending on which side of the aisle you're from, we can either look at that as the reason that we've been gerrymandered into three districts is to dilute the Tompkins County vote, or on the other side of the aisle, it says we have more representation because we have the ear of three senators. Well, let's take the second one and say we have the ear of three senators. I would like to see Tompkins County ask the three senators to come to a meeting, invite the press in, and ask them seriously what on earth they are doing in the state Senate because of what's happening to Tompkins County and the other counties. I think it's time that our senators, along with all 62 of them up there, were called on the carpet. If they come to a power-sharing agreement or they go out of session without coming to an end of the bills that need to be passed, we're going to have some serious repercussions. I think they need to explain themselves, and it's time that they move forward with the people's work. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Bernie Federley?
Bernie Federley from the Tompkins County Healthcare Task Force and Single Payer New York. We do not want a public option. We want a single payer system. A public option is not affordable for the patient or the government. A public option, according to the President Obama, the plan must have benefits equal to what Congress has and a lower cost than private insurance to be competitive and reduce costs. That's what he says. If you want to keep your employer health care insurance, you can have it if you want it. Well, let me tell you that private employer insurance is wrong. It splits the risk pool and does nothing to deal with the rising cost of health care. Employer insurance discriminates, excludes the unemployed and the self-employed. A public option fragments our health care system and becomes very costly. Only a single-payer system covers all with comprehensive and affordable health care. A fragmented health care system is a dangerous system. There's an article in the paper today. If you read it, you'll see just how foolish some people can do things. All right? They're very uneducated when they write like that. A single-payer health care system is what we need, and we hope that you give us that vote for it. And we'd also like you to know that we've had about 30 years' experience in this healthcare system, so I hope you'll have respect for what we represent. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bernie. We have Pat Long next. After Pat, we have Rebecca Elgin.
Hi, I'm Pat Long from Ithaca. And I've been doing a lot of research and reading, and I would like to support the single-payer health care system. And I could go into a lot of details about what I'm paying with Medicare, Medigap, prescriptions, and so on. Or I could talk to you about my hairdresser, single parent with two kids, full-time job, with insurance, goes into the hospital, has some problems, and trouble, the insurance wouldn't pay, had to go to social services, etc., etc. Or I could talk to you about my nephew, 39, who is working as a licensed massage therapist, but that's really kind of self-employed. He can't afford the health insurance yet, but he will get it in October. And when he worked, he did have it at a different job. However, I'd like to speak about a married couple, friends of mine. Some of you might even have known them because they sold their house on Slaterville Road and moved to Millport outside Watkins Glen. She is a certified nursing assistant, private duty. She had no health insurance, and she had a serious back injury which requires neurology and surgery, etc. Now, She's doing this under workman's comp, which is giving her trouble, so she had to get a lawyer. She was a hardworking young woman, and her husband moved with her to Millport to take over his brother's moving business. He also had no health insurance. At 47, last February, he had a heart attack, serious heart attack. And he's supposed to be doing cardiac rehab, et cetera, you know what it's all about, with no insurance. I don't understand why they don't have Medicaid, but as far as I know, and I know them personally, they do not have any insurance. They don't deserve this. They can go bankrupt, or maybe they already have. And they really need affordable insurance, which is transportable, and we need it for everybody in this country, as well as everybody in this state. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Rebecca Elgee. After Rebecca, we have Tom McDonald.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Elgee from the Tompkins County Healthcare Task Force and also Single Payer New York. We're working statewide to organize around this issue because we feel it's absolutely crucial. We're at a real crossroads right now and need to be sure that we get legislation that will truly fix our system. I think the examples that Pat gave are just three or four of what we hear every single day. And in fact, we have a young woman staying at our house because she had lost her job, was having problems keeping up with her rent. She has no insurance. She now has three part-time jobs, still has no insurance, had a toothache and had to go to the dental van that goes around in the community, which is a wonderful resource, had her tooth pulled, and then another tooth was bothering her, and she ended up having to go to convenient care. And this is just one simple story, and these are not life-threatening issues that she's having, but they are going to really keep her from being able to continue to keep on top of things financially and also physically. So I'm seeing kind of playing out before my very eyes on a daily basis what we've been talking about for the last many years that we've been working on this. I really appreciate that Martha and Will and Dooley kind of took this issue on and are bringing it forward to you tonight, because I think our legislators really need to hear from us. They are still in the process of making up their mind. We were at a meeting in Syracuse last night with Congressman Maffei, and he had a panel of experts from all facets of the healthcare provider system, and they were discussing the pros and cons of all the different systems. And he was still certainly listening and trying to get input on which way Congress should go, or at least he personally should vote. So I think this is a time when we can influence what's going on. I think the sooner we do it, the better. And we're going to be taking a bus to Washington on July 30th. We would be happy to take your wishes with us when we go to Washington and visit our Congress people there. And I would strongly urge you to move this issue forward and vote in favor of the resolution. Thank you.
Thanks, Rebecca. Tom McDonald, and then Deb Lipsay after Tom.
I'm for the single-payer system. A number of years ago, I lived in England, and I got treated under that system. I was given a card which said, if you wish to change your physician, you put the old physician under line A and the new physician under line B. No arguments with the old physician. You just mailed it, and you picked within the catchment area your new physician. When I had treatment with a particular physician that I was satisfied with, I was a Yank as a guest in the country, and I never had the feeling that since I believe he wasn't getting paid extra for a new patient. I never had the feeling that he was looking at his watch saying, you know, new guy, gee, I want to be pressed for time, so I'm going to cut you short. When I went to Germany, since I still had a fixed address in London, I carried my card with me, and I needed a specialist. It was an easy transfer to get a specialist, even without a primary care physician. And would we have, if we had a decent system here, would have our neighbors to the north having a reciprocal arrangement just as it was in the European Union? That would be fantastic. The other thing is I'm on Medicare and Medicaid. So the Medicaid is a secondary insurer. When I was living in Binghamton, I was overwhelmed with the amounts of tests and offerings from doctors. Did you have this and did you have this and so forth. When I came to Ithaca, still on Medicaid, I get this minimalist approach. No questions about colonoscopy. I'm a senior citizen. Manual prostate check. You don't rely on the PSA test because that's inconclusive. No offerings for that. I had to offer, can I have a colonoscopy test? I had to offer that. I had to offer, it's been a year since I've had a prostate check. Wasn't offered to me by the doctors here. So something's basically wrong with our system, and the people on the bottom really get the shaft.
Thank you, Tom. Bev Livesay, and then next we'll have Briggs Seekums.
I'm Beverly Livesay. I live in the town of Ithaca. And I've come to talk about resolutions H and I that are on your agenda, but I would just like to second what Mike Lane said about the state legislature, about the state senate. I think that is just, well, it's one of the examples of what's wrong with our democracy and that we need to do something to get it straightened out. I'm supporting both resolutions H and I. I know you'll probably pick one. They're both good. They're different. And I want to just speak a little bit. You've heard the story of why we need single payer. But I want to speak about why this board should pass a resolution unanimously supporting this and sending it off to our federal officials. This is an issue that is not partisan, although it's being treated that way in Washington. This is an issue that affects Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives, libertarians, everybody. And it's a crisis, I feel, of the proportion of Katrina. The people are just more scattered around the country. They lose their homes. They lose their health care. I mean, they because of their lack of health insurance. And they do, one way or another, finally get some health care. But the bills bankrupt them. Then they lose their homes. Many of them lose their lives because they don't get health care in a timely fashion. Now, I've heard it said that everybody gets health care in this country, and they point to the emergency rooms. And that's true. Sooner or later, just before they die, they get taken to an emergency room if they don't have anything else. Then it costs a lot, and the person has not had the kind of care that would have kept them a functioning member of society. Now, if you just think about it a minute, we are paying for health care for everybody in this country. Those levels of care vary a great deal. But how do we pay for it? We pay for it in taxes to pay for the health care for our elected officials, for Medicare, for Medicaid, various other ways. We pay for it every time we buy a product or have a service. We're making a contribution to the health care provided by that employer. When we make a contribution to a not-for-profit, if that not-for-profit can manage to have health care for their employees, then we're paying for it in our charitable contribution. So I hope you'll all look at this in the way that that it should be looked at. It's a crisis in this country. It's something that we're already paying for. We're paying for health care for everybody. Not everybody gets it. It's affordable, but single payer, which will leave out the high profits and high overhead of the private insurance, is what will allow everybody to have it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Beverly. If I could ask to everyone's indulgence, Eric, I believe, has to get to a 6 p.m. meeting, if that's okay to squeeze him in. Do you have a brief report for us, Eric, as a municipal official from Common Council? Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to the public. Eric Rosario, a member of Common Council, City of Ithaca, represent the Second Ward along with my fellow alderperson, J.R. Claiborne. And I'm just here to provide you with a brief municipal report. It's going to touch on three areas, and they touch on public health and public works that I thought would be of interest to you all. First, where we are with our impending decision on our water source. As you may know, the city is on the brink of making a decision on whether or not to rebuild our plant at Six Mile Creek or take a purchase option, which is to join the join Bolton Point in the commission, which includes other county municipalities. And I would anticipate, you know, but I wouldn't want to jinx this because it's been a few years in the making, that we'll be making a final decision in the fall at the latest. Before that, tomorrow, the Board of Public Works is going to be voting on the final environmental impact statement findings. And they're going to be making tomorrow a formal recommendation to council. So anyone who'd like to see that or make comments before they do that, that will be at their regular meeting tomorrow in Common Council Chambers at 4:45 p.m. And then moving on to the Commons, which is arguably the cultural heart of the city, but you know, not only for city residents, but it's also home to county residents and beyond. There were recent concerns that the Commons needed major repairs and upgrades to its infrastructure, including the surface, utilities, and other amenities like the pavilions. And we've hired a design consultant, Sasaski and Associates, to help us evaluate current conditions and come up with a design for repair and upgrade. And tomorrow's a busy day. Tomorrow there will be a public input meeting, because before we have Sasaki come up with a design, we'd really like them to have public feedback, and they'd like that also. It's going to be recorded, and they'll be using that in their design process. So tomorrow in the Tompkins County Public Library, in the Borg Warner Room at 5:45 p.m., where there will be a public input session on the Commons. We would like the public, everyone in the county, to tell us what they think needs to be done. And the focus, is on infrastructure. You can also email comments to our city planning department, and I'll hand this off to whomever I should hand this off to so that it can be, that information can be distributed. This is also public health. We are considering the potential regulation of outdoor smoking in public areas. This was in the news a while back. There was a subcommittee formed that's focused on this, that was working on this last summer and through the fall. This was initially the entire council was trying to tackle this last spring, and I suggested that a smaller task force should focus on it, and since no good deed goes unpunished, I was selected to be chair of that task force, and we've reactivated that task force after many of us had to focus on College Town and other issues, and we are hoping to have an ordinance to present to the legislative committee of council next month or September at the latest. And we're focusing on certain areas that we think are important to regulate outdoor smoking in. And those would include areas where there is a high concentration of children. So, for example, there are no playgrounds, which, let me put it to you this way. Smoking is allowed in all children's playgrounds. There's no regulation about that. So that is one area that we're considering, as well as others like outdoor dining, where folks can't readily escape from exposure to secondhand smoke. And this isn't just where we think or where we feel we should regulate. We're using as the basis for most of our work the only peer-reviewed publication on the effects and exposure of the effects of exposure to outdoor tobacco smoke, which is a Stanford study published in May 2007, which we're using as a basis for our thinking on all of this. So we want to rely on science as opposed to just what might feel right or feel good as we come up with this. And, well, actually, that's the meeting I'm heading off to at 6 o'clock. I'll be chairing our next meeting of that in City Hall, third floor conference room, if anyone would like to come in and hear. You're more than welcome to. And, you know, I guess I just wanted to touch on one other thing, and that's just our budgetary situation. I think the Ithaca Journal did a great job this morning of sort of summarizing the precarious situation we're in. One major source of revenue, our sales tax, has not been as resilient as it has been in the past few years. So if we're down at the current rate that we're down, and we're down by about $250,000, we'll be down by about $850,000 by the end of the year. And there's only so much the taxpayer can bear. So we're going to have some tough decisions ahead of us.
Thank you very much, Eric. I'm sure people can follow up with questions for you individually, but is there any particular questions people need to ask now? Carol Chalk.
Are the BPW meetings televised, do you know?
No, they're not.
Okay, I'm sure people may contact you individually, but thank you very much for the summary highlight report.
Thank you again for your indulgence.
Thanks, Eric. Get back to our speaking order. Briggs Seekums, and then Stephanie Dvorak.
My name is Briggs Seekums. I'm from Freeville. I am here to speak for on behalf and in favor of single payer. We've heard the word crisis used, I think, by every speaker, and it's definitely accurate to say that our health care situation is a crisis situation. 18,000 people, that's the best estimate, die every year simply because they have no insurance at all. By the time you get to the emergency room, it's and the idea that uninsured people just casually stroll into the emergency room is laughable if you've ever been uninsured or lived with someone that's uninsured. Every trip to the emergency room is, you know, is carefully weighed because it's going to be thousands and thousands of dollars of debt, or at least many hundreds of dollars of debt that you're going to have to take on. So 18,000 people dying a year simply because of no insurance. Thousands and thousands more are dying because they have insurance, they've paid into it, their employers paid into it, but then they get to a cap, or they somehow didn't disclose some detail that they were supposed to disclose, and they get denied. We have a situation, it's kind of baffling. I'm a veteran of the armed forces. I went to war for this country before I was old enough to drink legally, and it's extremely frustrating to me to at almost 40 years of age still live in a country where our elected officials seem to think it is okay to have a system set up where rich private corporations are able to make their profit by denying service. And we hear a lot of people using the term free market. Having read Adam Smith, I know when I talk to these people, they haven't read him, and they just like the word free market. It makes them feel good, like, I don't know, He-Man or cold beer or whatever makes them feel good, but it's a meaningless word when used to discuss health care and how it's going to be delivered. It makes no sense whatsoever. It's not a free market system. If you lower the cost of open heart surgery, it doesn't mean there's a sudden boom of demand for it, and vice versa. The only way that these corporations make any profit is by denying service, by taking money from people over and over every pay period, and then collecting that money, and then when it comes time to actually give the service they're supposed to give, coming up with some excuse not to give the service that they've been paid to give. So that right there is a definition of privateering. And if you folks are in elected office at any level at this point in American history, you need to know what the word privateering is, because it's what we've allowed our corporations to do to us now. And it's gotten worse and worse in my lifetime, which is longer than I like to admit, but not that long. It's gotten considerably worse over time. And this crisis, while it's a crisis of public health, it points to a bigger crisis, which is a crisis in democracy, which doesn't even exist at this point. We have a government for the corporations that can't be doubted. This is a nonpartisan issue, and the reason it's a nonpartisan issue is because both parties on this are out to lunch with corporate CEOs at steakhouses in D.C. instead of going into the Capitol and actually writing a bill that would serve the people. That's why it's a nonpartisan issue. The Kennedy bill that's been floated, the Massachusetts bill, is nothing but a mandatory tax that they're going to force people to pay to corporations. You people need to take the initiative on the grassroots level, our most lowest level of elected officials, because they're not listening in Washington. Thank you.
Thank you, Briggs. Stephanie Dvorak. And next, after that, we have Stephanie Argyrkas.
Hello. My name is Stephanie Dvorak. I live here in Ithaca. I'm a single mother, and I actually go to industrial labor relations up at Cornell. And one of the things that's just been reoccurring constantly is the cost of health care to employers. And generally, that's one of the first things that's dropped in a basket of benefits for employees. And I have a passion for human resources and working with people, so I've been studying that a lot. And every single professor I talk to, including the dean, Harry Katz, up there, they talk a lot about health care and also the options. And you learn a lot about the other European systems, which, honestly, from what I've seen so far, work pretty well. My daughter has chronic illnesses. She has eczema and asthma and severe allergies. I was recently given a call from Northeast Pediatrics, the pediatricians in town, Buttermilk, they're partnered with as well. They're no longer going to accept Medicaid. I don't have any other insurance for my daughter but Medicaid. I'm being forced to get a private total care, which is subsidized from the government through Medicaid, but essentially her specialist doesn't accept total care. So I'm given the option right now, does my daughter see her primary care physician or does she see her specialist? And given this juncture we're in, single payer is the only option for us as a people. And my generation, I'm younger. Nobody I know has health insurance. Nobody I know. Every single person I know. My sister went to Columbia, graduate. I have friends that went to Yale, they're graduates. They do not have health insurance. They're not offered that. That's the first thing that's cut with employers. I was flying one time from Los Angeles. I had a layover in Houston, Texas. My daughter had an asthma attack. We're covered under New York State. I fly a lot. I travel a lot. I was given a bill for about $6,000 for an ambulance from the airport to the Houston children's doctor there. I had to sign out against medical advice because I couldn't pay. I had no health insurance. I'm covered in New York State, but I'm not covered anywhere else. My child is not covered anywhere else. And this, for me, is a crisis. We're at the point now where we have to say, this is part of our infrastructure. Libraries are public. Police officers are public. Firefighters are public. It is vital to our infrastructure to have health care for every person. And if we are really a United States of America, where every state is connected, we have to have health care for every person as well. And this is a plea for single payer to be on the floor, because this is something I'm going to be working on definitely after I graduate. So thank you.
Thank you. Stephanie Argyrkas, and then Elizabeth Salome.
Hi, my name is Stephanie. I live in Freeville, and I'm a student. I'm a nursing student at TC3. I'm a personal trainer. I teach group fitness. I'm really into health and fitness. And it's all because I have an autoimmune disease that I developed about 5 years ago. It's a kidney disease, and it really has defined my life. It's something I think about every day, and it consumes my life. Even if I had the best of care, but I don't have the best of care because I don't have health insurance. So it's all in my hands. And when I moved to New York and I got sick again, it was really hard for me to find a primary care physician to refer me to a nephrologist so that I could get the care that I need. I basically live my life on prednisone all the time. And the preferred treatment for my disease is actually chemotherapy, which my doctor has admitted he won't ever prescribe to me because I can't afford it. There are certain tests that I need to see where the progression of my disease is at that, admittedly, my doctor is not allowing me to have because I cannot afford them. And so I live every day just trying to be in tune with myself and trying to know how I feel and am I okay. And really, it's a nerve-wracking thing. And I have ended up in the emergency room because I know that if I go to see my doctor or if I go to see a different kind of specialist, it's going to cost me so much money. And my husband and I have downsized to the point where we live in a studio apartment. And we've been married for 7 years. And it just feels like I'm trying to do the right thing. I'm trying to practice personal responsibility with my own health and with my bills. And I just can never get ahead. I feel like I'm always paying out and I'm not getting anything back. And so I got involved with single-payer health care, and I wanted to tell people my story so that they would understand what's happening. And what's happened is that I have people telling me their stories, and oftentimes I don't even get a chance to talk about what's going on with me because I meet people who have cancer and who have lost their job, and now they lost their insurance, and their last chemo treatment is in a week, and what are they going to do after that? And they don't know. And I don't know. And I just can't even imagine if I were in that situation where it was actually life or death at that moment. I mean, I'm meeting people right downtown, good people who, you know, who contribute to society and are otherwise very productive people. And this is the issue, is that I want to be productive in society. And I think, you know, a healthy society is productive. And healthcare, as part of a social infrastructure, is going to help that. I mean, we have public schools so that people learn their basic, reading and writing skills and their math skills, just so that they can function in society. And that's the same for healthcare. When I get sick, I feel like it's not that I feel like I can't work. I can't work. And I just hope that wherever I'm working at that time, that it's okay, that I can take whatever time I need off and not get any money, you know, and not work, so that I can just get better, so that I can come back to my regular life and do what I do. And I hope that that you pass this resolution on behalf of everybody, on behalf of yourselves, on behalf of probably relatives that you might have who need insurance, who don't have it right now. I don't think that the world would be a better place if I wasn't here because I didn't have insurance to pay for the treatment that I need. And I am one of many, many, many thousands of people, many millions of people in this country who need this infrastructure. We all need this. Thank you.
Thank you. And Elizabeth Salon.
Hi. I'm Elizabeth Salon. I'm a family nurse practitioner, almost 30 years of experience here locally. I'm going to tell you that my nurse practitioner colleagues, we have a Ithaca chapter of the New York State Nurse Practitioner Association. It's an Ithaca Cortland chapter, and we probably have between 50 and 100 nurse practitioners. We meet informally, so we don't do lots of formal things, but all of us would like to see single payer be instituted in the United States. So you would be really representing a lot of professionals who support this method of healthcare. Also want to just briefly say I have a daughter. She's married to a Brit, so I have very personal experience with what happens in the UK in their health system. My daughter developed a nerve pain where she had shooting pains down her arms, and it was probably because she was doing too much with the computer and other hard work they were building on the house. So she went to the doctor in the UK, and she got, you know, x-rays, and she got blood work, and she got physical therapy. And then I happened to be visiting, so I went with her to the appointment. And, of course, with my experience, I was listening and watching what they were doing. And I felt like, well, maybe she should have, like, an MRI. You know, maybe she's got a brain tumor in there. You know, mothers always think the worst. And so when I mentioned it to the physician, my concern, her response was, you know, it's a very slight chance that she might have something that serious, and I agree, I think I'll put her on our list. And that means that in a couple of months, 2 to 3 months, she'll be able to get this MRI. But honestly, as a nurse practitioner with all my experience, I wouldn't have ordered it either. In our practices, we have to always consider what we should order and the order in which we order that, so that we come to our diagnosis intelligently and not, you know, make a lot of expense for the patient, for the health insurance, for whoever is paying. She never had to wait for appropriate treatment, and in fact, subsequent to this, she was given a computer that she could talk to, so that she could continue to be a productive citizen in the U.S., in the U.K., do her work, and the healthcare system provided her with this essential way of continuing her work. That was covered. I couldn't even imagine a health insurance, private health insurance covering that. And my son-in-law, he took a soccer ball in his eye one day, and he had some difficulty seeing. They schlepped him off to the doctor. The doctor hospitalized him overnight for observation. Not likely to have been done in this country. He would have been seen in the ER and sent home. Another time, he got a cut on his leg, and it started getting a little infected. So my daughter said, you better go see the doctor. He goes to the doctor. They hospitalize him for 2 days for IV antibiotics. They are on top of it when you need it. And I encourage everyone to support this. You have a lot of good reasons to do that. And I have been giving a lot of my professional time to underinsured and indigent patients. I was a co-founder of the Ithaca Free Clinic. As co-founder of the Ithaca Health Alliance, president of that organization for a long time. That's just a Band-Aid. What we need is a big system. I mean, and if the government can run the post office and send letters everywhere for like 42 cents, I know we can do a better job if we took on a single payer with our government to do it. Thank you.
Thank you. That's the end of the speakers who signed up in advance, but we have time for other speakers who may be here. You can come to the mic and say your name and where you're from if you'd like to speak to any issue. If there's no one, we'll move on to privilege of the floor for the legislators. Martha?
Well, I want to thank everyone who came tonight to speak about this important issue. Everybody has a story. This is not some kind of a niche issue. We will be talking about it later, and I just wanted to make sure I let the public know of two phone numbers that are important, and thanks to Will for pulling it up on the computer. Our Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, 202-224-4451, and Chuck Schumer, 202-224-6542. The Senate... three Senate committees are dealing with this issue right now. You know, the next week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks are when basic decisions are going to be made. And as one of the speakers said, you know, when a legislator is sort of undecided, is when you need to speak to them. Once they've sorted all the input they think they need and made a decision, it's much harder, if you don't like that decision, to influence it. So again, the phone number, 202-224, and for Gillibrand, 4451, for Schumer, 6542. Thanks.
Thank you. Will Burbank.
Thank you, Mike. And thanks also to the people who came out tonight. I'm moved, to say the least, by the stories and the seriousness with which you have demonstrated the fact that this is not a theoretical problem. It's something that's affecting millions of people every day. And it's clearly the time is right now to do something. I did want to point out that we have two resolutions. They are not incompatible. Quite frankly, Dooley's will be considered first. Mine was specifically referenced to a House Bill 676, which is in favor of single payer. There are other bills. Bernie Sanders in the Senate has put another bill that I think is potentially even better. We may want to actually just consider Dooley's bill tonight, resolution rather. because that's conceptual, and I think it really conveys the message of single payer. And I also want to reinforce what Martha said about now is the time to really be speaking out at whatever level. One of the reasons that we wanted to have this discussion tonight is to give people an opportunity to speak at this level. It seems that what's happening in Washington is completely disconnected, and they need to be hearing from us. We need to be picking up the phone and calling them. We need to call the White House. I spent 20 minutes on hold today waiting to get to file a comment, but the woman was very nice when she finally took it. They have been hearing loud and clear from the opponents of reform. NPR has estimated that $140 million is being spent each day to fight health care reform. And hopefully citizens will be the counterweight to that. So thanks again for coming, but our work has just begun.
Anyone else? Carol Chalk?
Yeah. I will thank those who came out. I also found it moving, and as somebody who has had way more experience than I am happy to have had with the healthcare system, I truly don't know what I would do or how I would be functional if I didn't have good health insurance, and I think it's unconscionable that in the United States we cannot afford that to everybody. But what I wanted to talk about, what I came prepared to talk about, was I wanted to thank all of the public safety officers involved in this year's fireworks safety and traffic control. I had an incredibly wonderful experience this year, in contrast to some past years, getting into and out of the fireworks display. They were a wonderful display. It was one of these magical Ithaca moments where the clouds cleared after 20-some-odd straight days of rain just in time for a beautiful show. And it's great to see the community come out and support something that is just fun for those who like that kind of thing. And it isn't easy to control the traffic and keep everybody safe. I had to make a left turn onto Danby Road, and I had no trouble doing it. The traffic was kept flowing, and it just, whatever they did this year, I appreciated it. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Carol. Anyone else? Dula Keeper?
Well, I join Will and Martha in appreciating the turnout tonight. And I can hardly express my admiration for Rebecca, who has been devoting months of her life, Rebecca and Bernie, to this issue, touring the state. It was moving to listen to you all tonight. I heard people speak 10 and 12 years ago about this, and I can't believe we're still in the same profit-driven system we're in. I was happy when our now President Obama spoke earlier in his career saying, we must have single payer, and we'll have it when Democrats are in the majority. And now he seems to have forgotten his own phrase of yes, we can. This inside the beltway mindset that says it's politically infeasible to adopt this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. It just infuriates me. And I hope that we can join together and send that message that all of our Washington representatives should look outside the beltway and listen to what people across the country are saying.
Leslie, being clear, boy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a couple of quick things. Regardless of our opinions or thoughts or how we feel, I do want to make sure that they acknowledge that this world has lost a great man in Michael Jackson, a great performer, a great humanitarian. As I look at some of the research on the amount of monies he spent, just himself going into debt, but still making the choice to give to people and places that were in need. Today, the world, or since his death, the world has been mourning. And today, at the memorial service, it was very moving to hear some of the testimonies about all that he has done. I want to also thank the folks who came out to speak. I do know what it's like to have not had health insurance and being extremely scared and frightened and troubled and leaving the hospital despite Stephanie, the best doctor's advice that you shouldn't leave because I know I couldn't afford when that $15,000 bill hit. I've been there, and so I'm hoping that as a group, often we have these things that come that we're urging, and you know, we hear comments of, you know, we sort of stay out of the business of what the folks in Washington and, you know, the state are doing, but this is one of those things that we can't stay out of the business of, that we need to be a part of, and making sure that they hear loud and clear that not only for the people we represent, but for us as well, for those of us who know the experience of not being able to go to a doctor because you just can't afford it, and some of the self-medicating that happens and how dangerous that can be, that we do pass this resolution urging supporting the passage of this bill. It's very interesting. I want to tie this. There's a MLK community build effort. I don't know how many people know about that's been going on. And just today I had the opportunity of reading a short excerpt from Martin Luther King's book, From Chaos to Community, which is what the community build is centered around, that book. And that little excerpt spoke of, whenever this book was written, I don't even remember the year, but spoke of America being the richest country and yet having some of the poorest people because we fail to pay living wages or a livable wage to people like teachers at that time and social workers and healthcare workers, and we fail to provide the basic needs such as healthcare and food for many in our community. Now, this was written several years ago. Prophetic, I don't know, but it's still happening today. And we need to find a way to continue to encourage and build the momentum of what our president has been saying, that we need to make sure that every American has the sort of health care that he or she needs to cover those medical emergencies, and people should not have to decide between should I eat or go to the doctor. That should not be an option. So I would urge all of my colleagues to support this resolution as well. And I thank those folks for the personal stories you shared, because I know sometimes how difficult it is to get up there and tell the public about what your life has been.
Thank you. Frank Proto?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also want to thank the members of the public that came to speak. It was a pleasure to see you all, including Dr. Tyler, who we shared seats at elbow to one another for, it seems like, forever on the Board of Health. I just want to say about the resolution we'll be considering, and it'll save you hearing this from me when it comes to the floor. My major disappointment in this is that the individuals that brought these forward, as chairman of the Health and Human Services Committee, didn't have the courtesy to bring it through the committee structure so that we could have a full discussion on the pros and cons at that time and whether or not we should be bringing it to the full legislature at all, since it's federally it's a federal consideration. But the gentleman from Freeville that spoke about the grassroots effort, I appreciated that, because a lot of concerns do begin at our level, and I think that's a very real comment to be making about this. On another issue, I wanted to let you know, usually use this opportunity to bring you up to speed on consumer affairs. I wanted to compliment Congressman Akuri for having the guts to vote against the energy bill at the federal level. Any of you that have been following NYSEG's rate structure, like some of us have, if that passes, I'm afraid that the electric rates in upstate New York are going to be devastating. Mm-hmm. The increase will be something to behold, and I wanted to compliment him on at least having the fortitude to stand up. There were several others as well, but since he is a congressman that represents us directly, I think it's appropriate to pat him on the back and thank him for having the foresightness to not to support that particular bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any? Jim Dennis.
One last thing.
Sure, go ahead, Frank.
September 18th, we're having an open house at the Slaterville Fire Department. You're all welcome.
Thank you.
All day.
Jim Dennis.
Thank you, Michael. You all passed a resolution during the last meeting concerning some legislation that had to do with forming farm unions and things like that, put forth by a couple of legislators from deep in farm country in New York City. What that did for me, and the reason I'm bringing this up, is I received one letter and many phone calls saying they were disappointed that I had supported the legislation. In fact, I wasn't at the meeting, and I did not support the resolution. But what it did do for me, it gave me the opportunity to talk with people who were in the agriculture business, not only in this county, but in Schuyler County, and they told me about some of the problems that they have. One of them being, for example, a dairy farmer in Schuyler County, and believe me, I'm not running for anything in Schuyler County. He is getting the same milk price in this year that he was getting in the mid-70s. He has 300 cows that he milks. He has a degree from the university, and he has hired hands. And what he's literally arguing about with himself and his family, which has been a long time farm family, what I need to get out of this business because I'm losing money hand over fist. What troubles me about the legislation that you passed was that people who work on farms in New York State, who are literally, for the most part, undocumented folks, could never join a union because they would have to go through a process to get themselves to be citizens before they could literally join a union. And that in itself would put many people out of work. And, you know, it seems to me, as I've looked up the legislation from the people in the city, no one seemed to talk about who it was actually affecting. And that's a troubling thing.
Thank you, Jim. Kathy Lou Serrera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate somebody bringing that up because what my colleague, Mr. Dennis, talked about is something that wasn't really discussed a lot at the previous meeting. One of the intriguing and problematic things, first of all, about the dairy industry is that the way the prices are set, it's impossible now for dairy farmers to make a living. And, of course, as is the case in a capitalist society, the costs get pushed down to the workers. It is also true that the dairy industry, as well as the agricultural industry, relies a whole lot, not just in New York State or in Texas or in California, but across the Midwest on undocumented workers. This is an issue, not just a health care issue and not just a labor union issue. It's a dirty little secret of our country that we're living a better life on their backs. So I think it's something that is part of the whole broken system that is interlocked together. And I'd like to be able to assure you, Jim, my colleague, and all the people out there that are in agriculture that that we could fix this and that we could make it to where the workers that they have to employ, who will do the work at rates that they can afford to pay, could become members of unions. And it's my belief that the Employee Free Choice Act is a possible route to that, and that's why I supported it. Just to clarify that it's part of the whole fabric of dysfunction that we have here, where the multinational corporations are basically running our country, and we got to break loose. And that's one of the reasons that these kinds of grassroots efforts, even though they skirt process, and that's what I'll be talking about later on tonight, are so important, as Frank mentioned, and as several of the people who came here tonight mentioned. Now is the time, if not now, when, for us to speak up and start fixing this.
Thank you, Kathy. Any other legislators wish to speak on the privilege of the floor? If not, we'll move on. We've already had our municipal official. I don't see anyone else from a different municipality here to speak. So we have no special presentations. Under Chair's report, I've been asked by Joe Turcotte if you could just spend a minute and get your calendars out. He wonders if we could have a special budget meeting on the 22nd of July at noon. Apparently, that's when common council members are predominantly available. I told him already that noon was not a good time for many of our legislators. If they're...
The TCAT
budget meeting. It's a joint meeting with common council and legislature.
What's the date?
It's the 22nd. It's a Wednesday at noon. It'll probably take an hour and 15, an hour and a half. Can people give a show of hands if they are not available? One, two, three, four.
Can I ask a question? What's the time for the workforce diversity and inclusion?
3:30. Well, I'll try to do then, because we have four or five, looks like they may not be able to make it. I will see if there's a way we can start from scratch and send out a variety of options to both Common Council and Legislature. But we'll see what we can do. Frank?
One of the concerns around the meeting, some of us were doing, I know this will be a surprise, Jim, some of us were communicating by email. And the concern, and I want to thank Greg Potter for the help in that regard. One of the reasons the 22nd was the date, is this preferred date, was because the mayor, it had a personal concern, and we're trying to accommodate some of that a family concern that she has had, and that was a date that she could make, and she's been a player, and it's someone that we very much want to keep in the loop. I don't know what the alternate dates might have been, but we can check that. But okay. That is the date that certainly she can make, along with most of the Common Council members.
Well, thank you for checking. We will get back to you about whether that's going forward or whether we have an alternative. Jim Dennis is chair of the Budget Committee. Our draft budget calendar is still blank. What we will be doing for the expanded Budget Committee in September and October is scheduling 10 or maybe more special budget meetings of the entire legislature. And if you have particular times of day or particular dates that you know you cannot make, please get them to Tim or Jim and the Budget Committee so they can begin to get a draft calendar together. Jim?
Thank you, Michael, for your assistance. I was actually going to bring up during the committee report that if all of you could pick some times, send them to either Kathy or Norma, and we could kind of do a meeting wizard on times and figure out what the best times for all the legislators are, because we have had some discussion from department heads that they would show up. We asked them to show up, and we're not here. And that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So we got 2 months. Come up with some times, and we'll see if we can make it work. Thanks.
Quick question, Frank.
Jim, out of a show of interest, what month are we talking about?
September and October.
Just thought I'd ask.
Well, given how challenging it is to schedule 15 people's time plus department heads' time, we do have to start this early to get
this budget all day, every day. You know, I mean,
are the weekends in play, Jim?
And finally, I do want to congratulate the Tompkins County Public Library for their 4 millionth visitor. I mean, there's a small play in the paper about that, but I think it's really deserving of lots of kudos in terms of how much service they give to our community. I have one chair's appointment. Oh, I'm sorry, I don't. It's under the regular appointment. So we'll move on to County Administrator's Report. Joe Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a brief report tonight on a couple of items. First, to thank the legislators and department heads for attending the retreat, the quarterly retreat that we had a couple of weeks ago. I think that was time very well spent. Our goal was to figure out the best ways to inform, to communicate, and to have that result in good decisions during a difficult budget year, and I think we made a lot of progress there. By the end of the week, we will have notes of that meeting typed up and distributed to all of you and all of our department heads so we can see what we said and then take action to implement the recommendations that came from that. Second, a couple of speakers tonight discussed what was happening in Albany with the stalemate in the New York State Legislature. I think all of you received copies of a letter that we did forward last week to our state senators who represent the county regarding the impact of continued delays in a couple of items that relate very directly to our own budget, especially the sales tax. You know that one of the items that's being withheld is the extension of the 1% sales tax that has to be done every 2 years. And we thought it was important to articulate very clearly what impact that would have on the county if that, for whatever reason, were not to pass. And just to remind you, it would be a $2.4 million loss of sales tax revenue this year, the fiscal year that we're in right now, and another $9.9 million in revenue losses to the county in 2010. That doesn't take into account losses also for the city of Ithaca and the towns and villages that share in the sales tax. So I thought it was important to get that on record and to our delegation, and I think that may help them too in arguing to put together some kind of a process to break through this logjam. The second item that was in that letter referred to the landline surcharge, something that you had come into special session to ask the state legislature to consider. To give us the opportunity to think about whether we want to increase that tax to help pay for the radio communication system. That's also being held up by the current situation in the state Senate. So that was in the letter as well. My third area, I did attend a meeting of county administrators on June 26th. It was one of those misery love company situations where we all commiserated about our the budget realities that we are all dealing with, and it's important to remember that we are all dealing with the same problems. It's not Tompkins County. It's virtually every county and local government in New York State. As a part of that meeting, we did tour the Cook Chill facility in Rome, New York, not Rome, Italy, Rome, New York. It's operated by the state Department of Corrections. It was the first time I'd been through there. It's important because legislation was just approved, I believe, this year that will allow that facility to provide cook chill food to organizations that work with the county to fulfill our mission, like Meals on Wheels and food banks. Will have access to prepared food from the cook chill facility, which is really a state-of-the-art facility, very impressive. So I did get a chance to tour that. We also had an opportunity to talk about NYSAC's advocacy of taking some of the broadband money in the stimulus program and dedicating that to help pay for public safety communications. We made the point during the course of that conversation, though, that we also need to begin a discussion, and Lee Shurtleff has and NYSAC has as well, with the state about the wireless surcharge that was created by the state to pay for a statewide wireless network, a project that's been abandoned by the state, but the revenues are still being maintained by the state to pay for general things. And I think counties will be coming together as a group to talk about whether that money should be allocated to counties who have now been left with responsibility to develop these wireless communications networks and public safety communication networks. So we had a good conversation about that while I was there. So time well spent again with county administrators a little over a week ago. Thank you.
Quick questions. Will, then Kathy, then Dooley, then Carol.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Joe, for a good report. I saw a news report that Suffolk County is now suing such as the state Senate because of the fiscal impact on counties
And I was just wondering if there had been any broader attempt to bring action from counties up.
Not that I'm aware. That was the first time I had seen that also. I'm not aware of any statewide initiative. I wouldn't be surprised if that article doesn't stimulate a discussion about that, but that's the first I'd seen of a legal action.
Yeah. Kathy Lucerera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in that as well. The reason I wanted to talk to you, though, was the quick chill or the cook chill facility got my attention, especially in the context of our previous discussion about labor. Who staffs the facility, and how are they compensated?
The operation of it, the management of it, is by state correction department employees. The labor is provided by inmates of the Oneida Correctional Facility, a state facility. It was created to really serve the state's prison population, and it has since expanded to be able to provide capacity beyond just that need. So again, it's the labor that's used there are inmates of that facility. I was told, because I asked the same question myself about compensation, it isn't much that the prisoners are paid for that work. As I recall, it's about 50 cents an hour.
Yeah.
Which is more than their peers make in other jobs given to them in that facility.
Well, the part that gets me about it is that in talking about lowering of local area standards, as I did when we talked about the healthcare consortium, and then seeing an email a couple of weeks later from MoveOn.org urging people not to support the co-op, all I can think of is this is a way that New York State is trying to fill a need, but is utilizing inmate labor in a way that could be seen as lowering local area standards. Although food banks are a wonderful thing and we need them, and it's this awful monster that we're creating where we're eating our own tail. It's very, very, very frustrating. I think it's a interesting concept, but the exploitation is hard to not wonder about.
Thanks, Kathy. Dooley, then Carol, then Frank.
The statewide wireless network, you said, has been abandoned. I had read some articles that indicated it has been postponed. Has it officially been abandoned?
It has morphed into something much different than it was. It was to have been a state-led project with counties like Tompkins who participated, who did things on their own, contributed to that network, being compensated for their involvement in it. But basically, it was a state-led effort to create a wireless public safety communication system in the state. That was the basis of the wireless surcharge being developed, was to pay for that state, which is why the state kept that revenue. The trial in Western New York didn't work. And that particular project has, in fact, been abandoned. The communication that has occurred recently is more in terms of the development of regional systems led by counties, facilitated by the state, but the state's role has changed significantly from the implementer to the facilitator of those kinds of networks. And that's kind of a euphemism for shifting the burden of cost also to county governments.
Carol, and then Frank.
Yeah, you gave the $9 million figure for the sales tax, and
yes.
I recall you're mentioning an amount that would be equivalent to a percentage in 27%.
Your memory is very good. If we were to replace that revenue with property tax revenue, we would have to raise our levy by 27%.
And I raised this. I wish that we had the phone numbers right at hand of our state senators. If anybody has those and would like to read those out, we all should be calling and weighing in, because this has a real local effect. So I was going to read those phone numbers out. Anybody who would like to call in and say and weigh in that they really need to come together and do some business. For Senator Seward, that is 518-455-3131. Winner is 518 855-2091, and Nizzolio is 518-455-2366. Thank you.
Thank you. I have Frank next and Nathan.
For your information, they're in this book.
Joe, I have two items for you. One, let's stay on the sales tax a second. The $9 million and the $2 million are just the county share.
That's correct.
That's not the and that from the email you sent out that those numbers apply just to the county. The further concern is, and let me just use TCAT as an example, the city's piece of TCAT funding comes from their sales tax that we set aside in that agreement. So that could be their $800,000 to $900,000 contribution could be a serious blow with regard to the city. And my colleagues on the TCAT board, Pam and Kathy, we need to take that into consideration when we have that meeting. The other is the broadband. At the meeting, you know, I harp on the universal fund all the time. We are all contributing to our long distance portion of our phone bills for the universal fund, $6 to $11 billion a year, Karen, that is collected nationwide. We started a movement last year to ask the feds to allow legislation to go forward so we could tap the universal fund for broadband service. The legislation has to be amended in order to do that because the categories of the universal fund funds do not include broadband. When, with all due respect to Mike, when Tim Joseph and I went to Albany to speak with then Governor Spitzer, they were very interested at the state level in promoting going after the universal fund. Do you know, was there any discussion of that at the meeting, the meeting you were at with the county execs?
No, there was not, Frank. It was completely focused on the stimulus and the possibility of getting some of the stimulus money to support the cost of...
Do you think it would be helpful if we brought a resolution forward from this board? This is one that, that supports... asking our federal legislators to support amending the legislation so we can... I mean, I'd be happy to do that, but I want to make sure that we're not poking our finger in the eye of anything that you have going on with the state.
No.
Okay. We can bring something forward on that one. Thank you, Joe.
One last comment, Nathan.
Oh, wait a minute. One I know, Mike. Is the move going okay, Joe?
We don't have enough time, Frank.
Nathan Sinigawa.
I just wanted to say that we have a time allotted in our Government Performance and Workforce Relations Committee meeting on Friday to discuss a resolution condemning the actions of the State Senate and urging them to move forward. My goal, I haven't written the resolution yet. I just put it in there. I'll send it out to all committee members probably tomorrow or Thursday. But my goal with it is having a resolution that we can all support, Democrat and Republican, that really just gets to the nuts and bolts of the situation and asks them for action.
Thank you. Moving on to the county attorney, Jonathan Wood.
I do not have a report.
Finance Director David Squires.
I just wanted to report briefly that... we have been selected by the State Comptroller to participate in a review of the use of the Environmental Protection Fund grants. The county's had several grants, the largest one being farmland protection. And so the focus of the review, 10 municipalities throughout upstate, to see if the money is used wisely, if there's any impairments to the use of the money, access to the money. And one of the reasons why we were selected is because the largest grant we had was for the farmland protection, and we only spent half of it because the program requirements make it difficult for us to spend the money because of the technicalities in acquiring easements and on property.
What's the timing of that? The
review, they indicated they thought there would be an occupation for 2 weeks, starting today. So, and then they suspect it'll take them 30 days to but we're the eighth municipality that visited. So, and the two focuses, the county, two grants we've had have been for household hazardous waste and this farmland protection.
Martha Robertson.
One of the problems with spending the money, as I understand it, is how long it takes for all the steps to get through the state government. Mm-hmm. So are they going to take that into account?
Yes.
For example,
yeah,
the Hauser
farm? One of the focuses is to see if there's something inherent in the process that limits the ability to spend the money.
Is there any doubt what that is?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact that we haven't spent it yet is the end of the sentence. I mean, the yet part
right.
is... Okay.
And the a little known factor here about the sales tax, that about the extension of the sales tax, it calls into question our ability to service our debt, because $9 million annually is significant revenue stream for the county, and in our official statement, we have to disclose that the sales tax is contingent upon renewal every 3 years, and now we're in a situation where it expires on November. So the closer we get to November, the more market uncertainty there will be for municipal financing.
Can this be asked later, Frank?
No.
All right, briefly.
Is it possible to alert the Tompkins County Council of Governments to the sales tax concern? Because they'll be starting their budgets, and that sales tax is going to impact how we redistribute to them as well.
We're happy to provide
them
the information.
And get their support behind something like you're doing.
And we should know about the second quarter sales tax at the end of next week. So that'll hopefully will stabilize.
That's the end of the questions. I just want to add to my report that we will have a brief executive session for a matter of personnel at the end of our meeting. Can we move on to resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? Are there any to be added?
Is it possible to move the resolution up on the health care? I mean, I think there are people here.
Well, there's staff that's here as well. There's actually four resolutions. All have people waiting for them. Because a member filed, I probably will deal with them after the resolutions that staff are waiting for. Any resolutions withdrawn? We'll move on to the consent agenda. These are items that can be passed in a single vote. They're not considered controversial. May I have one appointment. This is to the Air Service Board, Leslie McBean Claiborne. And the resolutions include Resolution A, budget adjustments, various departments. Resolution B, award a bid, relocate runway 32, localizer array project, Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport. Resolution C, which is revised. Okay, it's off. Resolution D, authorizing a consultant.
Off.
That's off and will be considered under the F&I committee. And that's it. So we have two resolutions under consent. Who'd like to move the consent agenda? Frank Poto moves it. Martha Robertson seconds. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? That's unanimous. We will move to the resolutions that we have some public safety and other department members here for. Public Safety Committee, Martha Robertson, can you save your report and move to Resolution F?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Resolution F. The committee passed this today, adoption of intermunicipal law enforcement technology shared services, LETS group agreement and bylaws, law enforcement technology shared services, LETS. I so move.
And Kathy Lucevera seconds.
And there's a revised version in your packet, in your red folder, and those revisions are truly clarifications. I took comments from other legislators and walked through them with Kim and Greg this afternoon. The committee looked at each one in detail, and basically things like clarifying that the county budget is the budget that's at issue, that the order in which the bylaws would be ratified, that sort of thing, with the county first and then the other partners to follow. So the changes are in your red folder. If anybody doesn't have it, then holler. But they're in bold type, the changes that are there. You don't have it? I thought everybody had one.
So what's on the floor is the not revised, but we're considering adding possibly as friendly as the revised?
Well, the committee passed the revision.
Okay, so the revisions are in.
Does anybody need it?
I had a question about page 3 of the bylaws. There's a revision there on records.
Page 3.
The bolded bylaws on the bolded section, which is D under meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Language of in accordance with procedures as followed by the clerk of the legislature. These are simply minutes of essentially a task group.
It's of the board. No, this is a board. That's what the bylaws are establishing this as a formal group. And
Let's group is not a board. I would maintain that the Let's group gets to decide its own standards. I do not want minutes being taken at the same standard that our minutes of our committee meetings are taken at. I think that's an onerous. If we had all our advisory boards taking it at that level, we'd be possibly handicapped.
The intention is simply that it's a public record. Once the minutes are voted on, they will be posted publicly on the ITS website.
That's fine, but the word procedures, I wondered if that was the same standards of our committee meetings, and that's quite a different intent or interpretation of the language. The other questions about the now are being moved as the revised bylaws and agreement. I have Kathy, then Leslie.
I just want to explain why I seconded this. I think this has taken a little while to put together, and I think it's an example of collaboration, not forced cooperation, not jamming something down people's throats, and except for the changes at the last minute that I don't really know anything about, and that I'm going to have to take people's word that the committee didn't overturn any of the things that the municipalities and groups have worked so hard to come to agreement on. It's an example of what can happen when people decide to collaborate and listen to each other and work together and come to real consensus. I believe that this is the sort of thing that is leads to true cost savings, and I hope that the municipalities involved will reap the benefits of it that we will from having a cooperation and collaboration and consensus.
Thank you, Kathy.
Voluntarily.
Leslie McBean, Claiborne.
I, too, am happy to see that this is happening. At some point, I just need my memory refreshed. This operational cost of $50,000 is coming from where?
This is she's referring to page 2 in the agreement.
I am referring to page 2.
It is assuming, and this has not been passed, it's assuming that in the 2010 budget there will be $50,000 approved. At present, in the 2009 budget, there is not $50,000. There is less.
$30,000.
It's like $30,000.
And a certain level of services for 30 is being provided to try to, and this explains what level of services at 50 would be provided.
May I ask a follow-up? Did we at one point get some grant monies that supported this, or am I thinking of something different? Greg's shaking his head over there. Or some configuration of this?
Yeah, this project actually developed out of a previous COPS grant years ago. The result of that was passed on to ITS, a very small amount of that grant, in order to move the project forward to its current state.
Okay.
There are no grant funds left, nor have there been for at least the past 3 years.
And so, if I heard you, Mike, this is going on the assumption that in our 2010 budget, we will appropriate $50,000 for the continued operational cost of...
The agreement doesn't actually assume that. The agreement says if that amount is appropriated.
I said if I heard you right, okay. That is what you said. So what...
If $50,000 is allocated in our budget process, that is the level of service we would get. And Greg, I think at committee level, spoke to if a different allocation is given, they would have to renegotiate a lower level of service for these municipalities.
Thank you. You read my mind.
Martha.
I think Greg ought to explain it.
It's not really said.
Thank you.
Currently within the ITS budget, we have a separate budgeting unit for this particular project in the amount of $30,000.
Right.
Some of which is associated with software maintenance, hardware, professional services, and in addition, salary and fringes for a part of a position in my department. That current $30,000 does not cover adequately the amount of work that we're putting forward to this project. So we define what the minimum amount of requirements would be to support the project at its base level, determine that to be the $50,000 amount, and that's what I would be budgeting within the ITS budget if this is accepted and adopted. What changes is my approach that I would likely take in submitting my budget in 2010,
okay,
which is in the past 4 years has always been to put this project out as an OTR. So this would give me guidance and the specifics I need to move the project forward and for the participants to understand that there's commitment as well.
May I ask a follow-up, please?
Certainly.
So you're putting this in your budget, not bringing it as an OTR. Is this replacing something that will then come as an OTR?
It's too early to answer that question.
Mike Hattery.
I was involved in an earlier discussion about this, and I'm not necessarily advocating it, but there was some concern about contributions by other participants toward the budget for this activity. Where did that come out?
As part of the original resolution that was passed last year to get us to this point, there was the request to look at the financial impacts to do so. The first step that we did to get answers to that was to work with the county administration to review the alternatives on how to best fund this. Joe went through a process of evaluating what the impacts would be at the local level if there were contributions made from each of the agencies versus the county taking on the project as a whole. And at the conclusion and the recommendation at that point was to then have the county cover that base amount as opposed to distributing the cost across each jurisdiction.
Thank you. I have Martha, then Leslie, then Kathy again.
I'm going to say a thing or two, and then I would ask Greg a couple questions. This is the culmination of many years' worth of work by Greg and Kim Moore and all the participating agencies, and it's really, as Kathy said, a real product of collaboration. And I am, you know, really pleased. I mean, a couple years in a row, I remember we were asking, well, is there any leadership in the group? Is there any ownership in the group? And it was always kind of, well, not yet, and we're working on that. And we've heard at committee that there really is. We had several members of the group come to public safety to really speak in favor of this and to advocate for it. So we've really seen development of consensus and real ownership by the participating agencies. And that's a tribute to our staff as well as the agency staff that this is really coming to fruition. Two questions for Greg. Would you comment on, you know, you were asked today at Public Safety about how would the other partners feel about the changes that are brought forth here in the bylaws and the agreement? And if you could describe, not in your techie terms, but in your great, you know, civilian language, what does this provide? What does this give us and the agencies that we don't have without it?
The services that we currently provide are kind of defined in one of the documents there. But in essence, what it does is it provides for the centralization of all the records from all the police agencies throughout the county, including the sheriffs, all the villages, and the city of Ithaca. So they are able to query and look up information across each other's or sections of their database. So that's one thing, and that's centrally housed out of ITS and then remotely accessed, and all their updates are entered into the same system and through the process. In addition, we also provide a lot of coordination for state-based applications and access to state systems We recently cut over to an upgrade of our connectivity to New York State, for which all the villages and the city of Ithaca utilized for access to state-based applications through the Department of Criminal Justice Services, as well as the Probation Department. We also provide a lot of technical support for mobile-based interfaces within the vehicles, including TRAX, which is a ticket-based system that allows for the electronic use of tickets from the vehicles as opposed to handwritten tickets, and that automatically as well gets transferred to the state. So as state initiatives occur, the county assists in taking the lead in the deployment and the review on behalf of the city and the villages, and the city also participates at a higher level on the IT side as well, since they're a much larger organization.
And about the changes in the bylaws and the agreement?
Based on our experience in working with the participants in this project, I don't see any problems with the changes that are proposed.
Okay. Thank you.
Leslin, Kathy, then Dooley.
Mr. Chair, I will yield to Dooley since she hasn't spoken.
Sure. Dooley Keefe.
Thank you. Two things. I appreciate this having finally reached us. I'm excited to see it happen officially. And I appreciate the clarification you got for some of the details. But there's one place where it doesn't refer to the full membership, and I wanted to just ask in general, every time there's reference to majority vote, two-thirds vote, three-quarters vote, does it mean of the full membership so that if there's a vacancy, that doesn't count? You have to count the full membership?
Yeah, I believe so. We talked about that because there was originally a place where it was sort of a quorum was a subset of the full group, and
right.
then you could have something passed by a majority of the quorum, and we said that
that's
wasn't
different.
Enough. So, of the group, it means of the full membership, right?
There was just one place in here where that change didn't get made, and I will point it out later. I don't want to do that now. But the other thing is that the resolution that's before us probably has to have the date in the resolved portion changed to refer to revised bylaws dated July 7th instead of bylaws dated June 23rd.
That's friendly to me.
Okay. And Kathy, the second, do I think that's friendly, the date?
That's fine with me.
Okay. Back to Leslie.
So, Martha, you brought up the leadership issue, and I was trying to read the bylaws because I know that was one of the things that we had concern about, and a lot of it does rest with IT, and I read here that the individual members of LEX would talk with Greg if there are things they need or not need, so I'm just interested in finding out more about what the leadership structure would look like, not the chair, vice chair, that stuff that's in here, but in terms of direction given to Greg and who does he report to, sort of that piece.
Go for it, Greg.
Yeah, there certainly is an administrative component of the project that's spelled out in one of those sections. ITS would take over that administrative responsibility as defined within that $50,000 mark that we're shooting for within the project limitations. So we will be managing the administrative aspect of this. As items are discussed or approached that require additional review, the next step up would be the Public Safety Committee. But internally, the intent is to establish the chair, the vice chair, and whatever, just those two positions. Thank you, Ken.
And if I can follow, and also if there are other tasks that are sort of beyond the baseline, the point is not that the county then just assumes added expenses, but that the group understands that any additional expenses, they will have to come up with a formula for funding those.
That is exactly correct.
Thank you.
Yes.
Dan Leslin?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Thank you.
Kathy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I got a copy of the revisions, at least for the group agreement, and they are tiny, just for the publics and anybody else that didn't get a chance to see them. Like the addition of the word Tompkins County, the addition of the word group, the addition of the word bin. I don't have any problem with that. The original comments that I made, and the reason I want to stress them now, is that this is an accomplishment, not just because it's law enforcement and not just because it's intermunicipalities. It's because it's us here in Tompkins County coming to consensus on something. And I think it's a really important thing to notice that this wouldn't have worked if it had been imposed on someone, wouldn't have worked if it had been pushed through. It's I think, a really good example. And I hear Leslin asking questions, and I think that it's important to recognize that real consensus doesn't mean complete unanimity. It doesn't mean a lack of oversight. It doesn't mean that there won't be questions. I sort of wondered about that $50,000 base operation myself, and the way that I resigned myself, or at least decided to support this, is it's a two-year renewable shared services group, and then at the end of that, it could be renewed for an additional 5 years. This is something that we're starting out with. We're going to look at it, and we're going to go with it. I think it's really innovative. I think it was much needed, and I just want to say that despite questions that we might have and how we might be refining this as we go, I'm really glad we're doing this.
I'd like to move to vote if possible. And there's no further questions. Frank Proto.
Just a compliment, Mr. Chairman. I think it, if it hasn't already been said, I think the work that's taken place between ITS and our own administrative department is shouldn't go unrecognized. As I understand it, there was some grant money that came through to help out with this, and your department deserves a pat on the back as well for some technological support.
Are we ready to vote? All in favor of the revised Resolution F?
Aye.
Are there any opposed? One opposed. It passes with one opposed. Thank you very much.
Okay, and I have Resolution G. You wanted me to go on? I guess staff might be. All right, Resolution G, and it's revised in your folder. Resolution urging passage of state law regarding text messaging while driving, and I so move.
And seconded by Nathan Shinagawa. This is the revised version. Is there a discussion? Mike Hattery.
Yeah, I was wondering if we could get the sheriff to comment on this before he leaves.
I think he was sprinting out the door as you were asking that.
My question is, my understanding was the previous version of this that was considered in committee, which was for a local law, we had concerns from our law enforcement officials about the ability to enforce, and from our district attorney about the willingness or ability to prosecute.
Correct.
Why aren't we encouraging the state to pass something that our local law enforcement people have trouble thinking about enforcing, and our district attorney has problems thinking about prosecuting?
I think if it becomes a state law, the district attorney's problems essentially go away, because then it's a uniform, you know, it's clearly in her jurisdiction, as opposed to something that she would see the town courts, the local justices needing to enforce. As far as the sheriff and other law enforcement, if it's part of a state law, then it goes on the regular ticketing system that, you know, basically comes through tracks or through the state, instead of having to write up a special ticket for the local law, and it just makes the administration of that smoother. It doesn't, the sheriff's problem more was that, compared to talking on a cell phone, which is invisible when somebody's in a car, it's pretty hard to tell that somebody's looking at a handheld device. I don't think necessarily that it's impossible. I think it is difficult to see that. But I think it does give law enforcement a tool if there's evidence, if they can tell that somebody's using a device that way. And other jurisdictions, other states have passed these bans, and I think has the benefit of really sending a clear message that if the state passes that, it sends a clear message this is dangerous and life-threatening, and I hope then that we can see some public awareness of it.
I have Nathan and then Mike Sigler, and I'd like to go to a vote as steadily as we could. Nathan?
Yeah, I
Thank you for, first off, public safety, for discussing this over the course of three meetings, and I'm glad that we were able to get something out of committee. This resolution, the reason why I support a state law for this, even though I support a local law as well, but I support a state law especially because it gets at the cultural aspect of text messaging better than a local law can. And what I mean by that is that for a local law, the most that we can do is fine somebody if we catch them using text messaging while driving and fine them, you know, say $150. The state law does that, but not only does it do that, it also puts it messages about how text messaging while driving is not okay in permit tests, during the exam portion of permit tests, and also the classes that people have to take. It adds that educational component to other aspects of the Department of Motor Vehicles training overall in how to drive, and so that gets to some of the cultural aspect of it as well. And also, the reason why that the cultural aspect of letting people know that it's not okay is simply because a lot of people think it's okay. That you have, you know, polls that done by the AAA have shown that, you know, that young people between the age of 18 and 25, which I will soon be out of that category, by the way, I want you all to know, give me a couple months. But that group of people thinks that it's perfectly fine and okay that to text message while driving, and we need to send a clear message that it's not, and that you actually put the lives of others in danger when doing that. So that's why I support the state law. Also, for the enforcement issue, I think that you would. One of the things that the sheriff talked about was how even when he does the cell phone checks, he actually requires like two cars to do that. One to catch the person doing it at one point, and then another car a little bit down the road to also catch them to back it up. And then so they actually have to set up like cell phone monitoring kind of, you know, I guess, what's the word for it? Kind of checks. Yeah. And you could do the same with text messaging, but you won't catch everybody, obviously, because you can't see them text messaging itself. But also, I think that this is one way to approach this, too, is that it's an added penalty when an accident occurs or something occurs, it's an added penalty if found that they were text messaging and that was the cause of the accident or helps have that accident come about. Just like how the truck regulations that are in, will hopefully be finalized soon. There's no way, it's very hard to tell if a truck is actually, you know, local or coming from New York City. But when they get stopped for other violations, if it's found that that truck is actually from New York City and could have gone through the interstate, then they get additional fines. Likewise, I think you could do the same with this type of law.
Thanks, Nathan. Mike Sigler?
Well, I'm pretty sure this will pass. I'm pretty sure this will pass the state. Of course, I have to vote against it because I didn't commit. But first off, I don't think the DA and the sheriff worried about jurisdiction as much as they're really not clear how they're going to prosecute this. It's difficult to prove somebody was on a text message. I mean, granted, if they had an accident or something, you could say, oh, there was a text message sent at this time from you, which is what they're doing with some train accidents now. I feel like we're kind of legislating common sense at some point. Like, you know, I don't want people to think that I'm all for people text messaging in a car while they're driving. But do I really need to tell citizens that?
Yes.
I don't think you do, Dooley. I'm sorry. It's like saying that, you know, kids shouldn't car surf. I get to the point where I'm like, you know, I'm sorry that people will do stupid things. But I don't think, you know, once we make everything a crime, then everybody's a criminal. That's generally where I'm coming from in this. Also, as Nathan just said, to prosecute, like, even the cell phone law, you need two cars. I don't see that as where I want the manpower of the sheriff's department to be focused. I don't like the fact that it seems to me a lot of police organizations today are more tax collectors than they are actually enforcing, you know. I would rather see cops walking the beat in neighborhoods than going and ticketing people on Route 13 for talking on a cell phone. That's just my general view of police enforcement. And I see this as just being one more way to rack up a bill when you pull somebody over. Oh, you didn't have your seatbelt on, you were talking on the cell phone, you were text messaging, and you were eating a McDonald's hamburger. Yeah. I think at some point you have to say, you know what, I don't really think that's what our police forces should be doing. I would rather them be out walking the street and making sure the citizenry is safe from criminals, you know, people actually committing serious crimes. So I think that the more things we pass like this, the further away we move from the core mission of police departments.
If Carol and Jim will remind people we're getting close to our two-hour mark, I'd like to move towards a vote, and then we have two other resolutions that the public is waiting for. Carol?
I have the opposite perspective than Mike, which is not unusual. I wish that we were still passing a local law, and I was lying there yesterday morning thinking, oh my gosh, the state. I understand the need to do this on a state level, and I understand that that provides a public education component and a sense of education. I hope that that as we move forward, whether it's law or not, that we would consider some kind of public education campaign about how unsafe this is. But I was lying there yesterday thinking, oh my gosh, if the state doesn't come together and start to do business and pass something like this, if even one kid dies or, heaven forbid, kills somebody else before this gets passed, I mean, I'll never forgive myself for not pushing and holding out for us to do something locally. And I think we have a population in this county that is at higher risk than the general population for this kind of behavior that is dangerous. You know, it's one thing if you're not wearing a seatbelt and you put yourself at danger of getting hurt more seriously than if you weren't. But for texting, I think you're really putting other people at danger, and that is where I draw the line and think that the state does have a role to play. I do hope that we will encourage not only think about what to do in public education ourselves, but encourage our high schools, colleges, and universities to do so, in particular once a law is passed. And I will... I don't sense that there would be sympathy for my submitting the amendments that I started to jot out to put back in the local component. So I will not do that now. But if the state does not come together on this in the next 6 months or year, I would like to reserve the right to bring it back and not be told later that, well, we did that and we decided to take the state approach, because I think it will be important to revisit it at that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. Jim Dennis?
The new state law that's being put forward, and anyone can correct me if I'm wrong, is a violation if you are seen holding a device, not necessarily talking or texting. Is that?
Right now,
it's talking or, I mean, we don't have texting, but the state law is going to, it's my impression, is going to generalize if you have a phone visible, then they can stop you. And that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
The other things, you know, really don't.
I have a couple people who want to talk for a second time, but I think Pam has not spoken for a first time. Pam?
I think everything I was going to say has been said at least once, so I guess I'll pass. Thank you.
Okay. And those who wanted to get a second mention is Nathan, then Martha, then Mike Hatterick.
Very quick, I just wanted to say that this actually passed the New York State Assembly and is one of the many pieces of legislation that's being held up by the state side.
Martha Robertson.
Yeah, one reason not to do a local law and really wait for a state is that we have so many young people from out of the county who, you know, if it's a state law, at least there's some consistency. And I noticed that there are no names next to Senate Majority Leader and Senate Minority Leader, so that's good.
Mike Hattery.
And that's it, right?
Okay.
I just want to make the point that there are a variety of things that are dangerous activities that we have very effective public education programs for on a state and a national level, but we do not have, that don't require a law prohibiting them, that has difficulty in enforcement.
And briefly, Dooley, then Nathan again.
Nathan, unless the Assembly acted today, I don't believe that they actually had passed the law. I was prepared to offer an amendment to this resolution saying that the Assembly has passed it, but the Senate is holding it up. But I asked Karen Fuller to please look for the bill number that passed, and Karen checked with Barbara Lifton's office and was told that it's still in the works.
No, it passed on, I believe, the
17th. 17th of what?
Of June. Yeah, I have it. This one happens to be from the North Country Gazette. Albany passes ban on text messaging while driving, June
17th,
2009.
There's some kind of amendments that
are
being made according to Lifton's office.
Oh, okay. I mean, I'm sure that, yeah, I mean, that will happen. If it goes to the State Senate, there will be a conference.
Yeah.
Are we ready to vote on the revised version of Resolution G?
Just real quick, on Jim's point, the actual provisions are, it prohibits the use of handheld mobile telephones, PDAs, handheld devices with mobile data access, laptops, pagers, electronic games, and any portable gaming devices to compose, send, read, view, access, browse, transmit, save, or retrieve email, text messages, or other electronic data while driving. So,
great. Are we ready to vote on revised Resolution G? All in favor? Any opposed? It passes with 3 opposed. Thank you very much, Martha. We'll come back to you.
I reported at the last meeting on the Public Safety Committee meeting of the day before. So the only thing to add is that the next Public Safety meeting would be July 20th at 2:30. Thanks.
Okay. So we'll consider that your report. We're going to move on to our member file resolutions, which people have been waiting. Well, Bob, you'll have to wait a few more minutes until after that, I think. Bob Nicholas came for his resolution. We have Resolution H. Dooley Keeper would like to move the revised resolution.
Yes, I would. It's reaffirming support for a single-payer approach to controlling health care costs and ensuring everyone is covered. And I move that.
Is there a second? Will Burbank seconds. Is there discussion?
I wanted to respond to Frank's concern expressed under privilege of the floor that it didn't go to committee. And the reason I felt it didn't absolutely have to is that we're reaffirming something we did 3 years ago for the state level. At that time, we recognized single payer as being the most desirable approach, so it seemed unnecessary to put it through committee again. That's the only reason. And since we heard tonight how timely this is, I hope it will pass tonight. I also would like to respond to the comments that we heard under public privilege of the floor. There is a version, the revised version has a rather colorful final resolve that talks about what seems to be happening in Washington, but it also makes a public option, as long as it's a true national single-payer public option, as a fallback position that we would support. And I'm no longer sure that that is a good strategy. I would be content to remove that and simply put the phrase, escape the inside-the-beltway mindset that major reform is politically infeasible, up in the next-to-last resolve. It's the other thing that they need to do. But I'd like some feedback on that before changing this, moving to change it.
So what's on is still including the resolve that's in the revised as bolded. I think I had Nathan next, and then I saw Kathy's hand.
All right, I have very lengthy comments on here, which I will try to trim down here.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate all the comments that people had, especially the personal stories. I won't tell any personal stories. I'm just going to go straight to the wonkish kind of aspect of it, since this is what my professional background is in. I work for a hospital, and also because I just finished grad school and have had a lot of chance to study these things. I believe that single payer is the best option. I think that in terms of administrative costs, studies have shown anywhere between 22 and I think 34%. I think the 34% is from the New England Journal of Medicine of administrative costs. Of costs could be reduced that are purely administrative. And this is mostly about 80% of those costs are private industry, and the majority of those costs are things like paying for advertising, fighting against fighting issues with denials and underwriting costs, et cetera. Also, single payer is the only option really that has the true economies of scale that would produce large savings. Also, it has the power to direct wholesale change to the system. You know, that when you have one unified system, then you can actually say, well, we believe in evidence-based medicine. And you could have the entire country go and use treatments that are oftentimes cheaper and better and more proven to work than others. When people criticize single payer systems in other parts of the world, people need to realize that those other parts of the world also spend half as much per person. I mean, we spend twice as much as they do, and 45 to 65 million people aren't even covered in our insurance plan, and we still pay twice as much as they do. So if we paid even 25% more of what Canada pays per person, we would have inevitably a far better system of healthcare that would have very many less of the problems that people discuss. With that said, the discussion in Washington is very much focused on a public option. I believe today the Senate Health Committee has support amongst all of its Democrats for some type of public health option. So what I want to lay out real quickly is what I believe are the only criteria in which I would personally have if I were to support a public option. And the criteria is as followed. First, the public option needs to be administered like Medicare by the government. And it can't be contracted out to some private company, because then you're going to have the same mess that you have with things like Medicaid, which are private, which is contracted out and doesn't deliver the same level of quality of service that, say, Medicare does. It must be available to all and affordable to all. That means even subsidizing it for people that can't afford it. Subsidizing low-income people. It also, and this is crucial, and this comes from my perspective, is that it needs to have reasonable reimbursement rates. And what I mean by that is that currently, under the current healthcare structure that we have right now, if you're looking at a hospital, your hospital, whenever there's a Medicare patient, that Medicare patient is only giving you about 80% or so of your costs. For a Medicaid patient, it's 60 to 70-some percent of your costs. And so the only way that you could really survive and make a margin, and remember, a margin's important because it allows you to invest in technology. It allows you to keep up your facilities. In order to make a margin, they have to rely on the private insurers that pay anywhere from 100 to 115% of their costs. And so so that's the way the system's set up right now. A public option, I really think, needs to have competitive reimbursement rates that are better than Medicare. Because one of the things that's a flaw with both Medicaid and Medicare right now is that there are so many people that don't even have access to primary care physicians, because primary care physicians can't take any more of those patients because they don't cover their costs, right? And so if public option is really going to work, it really needs to have competitive reimbursement rates, which is tough because it means it will cost more. But we really don't want to sabotage it, and we don't want to set it up to fail. I believe that public option really needs to have a focus on using its economies of scale to directly negotiate for drug prices. The VA has the ability right now to directly negotiate with drug companies. Medicare does not. And as a result, the VA on many drugs has a quarter of the price that Medicare Part D provides, has for drugs. So those are a few of the things that I think would make a public option worth it. And I just wanted to say that because that is kind of the way that the debate is going right now. That even though I believe in single payer, I just wanted to put those points out there because public option is what is being discussed right now. And I think those points are are important to make.
Thank you, Nathan. I have Kathy, then Mike Hattery, then Martha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dooley, I appreciated your suggestions about changing the final result, because it wouldn't be acceptable to me with a public option in it. In fact, one thing that I thought of in looking at it for me would be to take the first resolved and the second resolved and reverse them and just leave it be. But having said that, I know we're going to do a bunch more tinkering, and the reason I know that is because this didn't have the benefit of going through committee. Those of you that are tuned in to me are going to know that I'm going to talk about process now and say that, yes, it's a crisis, but I've seen this juggernaut before in operation, and I wasn't privy to the discussions that surrounded the bringing of this to the legislature, not just because I don't go to caucus anymore, but because nobody told me about it. Now, Frank's the chair of Health and Human Services. Somebody should have told him. I think it's really interesting that the juggernaut decides to push something forward, and as long as you've got the majority vote, consensus, collaboration, whatever, is not going to happen. Sure, I'm going to vote for this. Of course, these are my values. But what kind of a discussion is this anyway?
On to Mike Hattery.
I wanted to note that fortunately we did not have any any testimonials tonight of the very real failures of more nationalized healthcare systems. And I hope we never do have to hear any of them. Beverly Livesay noted that this isn't a partisan issue. It may not be partisan, but there are very real differences in what people think are the best way to get to a better path forward in healthcare. I don't think anybody thinks we don't have a broken system. And I'm always surprised when local officials who, in the very same meeting, Twitter about how, I shouldn't use the word Twitter anymore.
Good.
Giggle and roll their eyes about the ineffectiveness of working with the state and the federal government, and then think that things are going to be better if we either turn it over to the state or federal government.
Thank you, Michael. Martha Roberts, and then Will.
I wanted to say something about Pat Vaughn's question to herself about why this couple that she knows wasn't on Medicaid. I would point out that if you're a single person making minimum wage, you make too much money to qualify for Medicaid. So Medicaid only covers the very, very poor. And it's a good thing it does, but there's a huge gap of people who aren't covered in any way. I would also like to point out some of the places in which we already pay for health care. People say how expensive this is going to be, but they never, in fact, the Congressional Budget Office estimate, I think their early estimate of one of the plans was $1 trillion, they admitted that they did not have a way to estimate the savings. So all they did was calculate the cost, and they didn't subtract the savings. So just in terms of local expenses and county government, I'm going to steal from something Tim Joseph wrote in 2007. And he put out a list of all the places in which county government pays for health care. That means property taxes, sales taxes locally pay for health care. Our Office for the Aging. We have a 10-person staff or so, and most of their work consists of helping seniors to navigate the healthcare system. Our personnel department has a full-time benefits manager, and if the numbers are a little off because this was 2 years ago, you get the idea. Personnel department has a full-time benefits manager who's mostly occupied with helping employees deal with health insurance. When we negotiate with our unions, healthcare is always the biggest topic. We have a healthcare consultant on retainer to help us work out these costs. At least two-thirds of the staff time devoted to collective bargaining is spent on healthcare issues. We put in hundreds of hours of staff time to putting together the prescription drug discount card. Well, it's great, but it still is only a 24% or 22% discount to people who are using that for their prescription drugs. We got, in terms of state money, we felt really great that we got a $400,000 state grant, but that's still taxpayer money, so that we could form the healthcare consortium. We had to hire a consultant to help us through that process and define the plan. And, oh, by the way, I'm really delighted that the city passed, joined the healthcare consortium, so we do have the 2,000, we have more than the 2,000 covered lives that we needed. So that's prepared to go ahead. That's just a tangent. But We have staff in our mental health department, public health department, and Department of Social Services devoted to collecting fees from private insurers so that we can reduce the public cost of programs. We have people sitting in jail because they're waiting for the judges have said that they're ready to go to rehab, but DSS staff and nonprofit staff are working to see if they can get them covered on Medicaid, on public, again, public payment for those costs. Our economic development staff talks often about entrepreneurs who would like to start their own businesses, but they're tied to a job because of health insurance. And just in terms of the community, the economic life of the community, health care costs stifle job growth. Business owners are often, they often say that they can't hire more people because they can't afford the insurance. Health care costs clearly increase the cost of American-made products compared to other countries and decrease our own competitiveness. We see healthcare professionals routinely leaving healthcare service because, you know, they can get a job in an insurance company, and this contributes to our severe shortage of nurses and physicians. Providers at all levels have to pay their own staff to manage insurance billing. When I go to my primary care physician, there's an office, a whole room with a couple people in it, surrounded by records so that they can manage insurance billing. Employees lose productive work time fighting insurance company denial. How many people have been on hold, right, for 2 hours just to try to get even a question answered? It takes productivity away from all of us. And we are already, as was said before, we are already paying for emergency room care that's unreimbursed. So this is the most expensive care and the least effective care. And so this is just a partial list of the ways we're already paying for this ineffective, way overly expensive system. And I really urge that we will vote on this tonight. We did have a full discussion a couple of years ago of this issue in committee. I'm pretty confident everybody's well aware of the issues, and I think the time is now to send this to our federal legislators, or else it's pretty much not going to be nearly as useful and effective. So I really hope we vote on this tonight.
I have five speakers lined up. I'd like to truly move quickly through this so we can come to a vote. Will, then Mike Sigler.
Thank you, Mike. I'd like to speak to the process. When I started thinking about the need for a resolution, I originally envisioned that it would be presented at this meeting, referred to the committee, and brought back. And I'm sorry, Frank's temporarily out of the room, but I was certainly no attempt to slight the Human Services Committee on which I sit. I think it would be a very appropriate place. That being said, I think this is a moving target. It is the timing. Nobody knows how quickly this is going to happen, but it seems that things are happening at very quickly, and I think it's time to reaffirm the stance that we took 2 years ago. It was very disheartening to pick up the paper and discover that the president's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, yesterday was quoted in the Wall Street Journal to the effect that the White House, at least, would be open to compromise and the possibility of entertaining a trigger mechanism, at which point, if conditions got so bad, then maybe we would then invoke the public option. And President Obama, to his credit, quickly said, well, that reached in Russia was quoted to the effect that I wasn't completely exactly where he was at. But we don't know where he's at. I think it's time for us to express where Tompkins County is at, remind them that there's vast support for a true radical reform moving to of our healthcare system, and do it now.
Mike Sigler.
Well, while I applaud many of my legislators and my colleagues for their words on this issue and their commitment to it, and I thank people for coming,
I frankly don't see this as anything short of a threat to my family's welfare, my wife's welfare, my children, and perhaps their lives. So I'm committed to fighting against you on this, basically all the way to the end. 85% of the people in America have health insurance. The most recent poll I saw is, yes, 85% have health insurance. You know, 47 million sounds like a lot, but there's 320 million people in the country. And a lot of those people that are in that 47 million are without health insurance maybe right now, but they have had health insurance within the last year. Putting that aside, out of that number, almost all of them are happy with the health insurance they have. The people in the latest poll that I saw who don't have health insurance but still went and got health care, 40% are happy with the health care they received. So while I admit there is a problem, we do need to cover the people that aren't covered. A complete revamp of the health insurance industry and the health care industry in America, I think, is unwarranted. I think even if you just go out and look at some of the universal health care that's offered by some of the other countries. You know, I'm glad that the one woman here spoke about Britain and how she had a great experience with Britain. Not everybody does. I mean, for every good story I hear other stories about how bad they are. 14% of all patients in Great Britain, they have to wait more than a year after being referred by a general practitioner. Half of all the people, the national health care patients in Great Britain, they wait for 18 months at least. 18 months to 52 weeks before treatment. You look at Canada. Right now, 10,000 women, breast cancer patients, are filing a class action lawsuit against Quebec's hospitals because on average, they were forced to wait 60 days to begin post-operative radiation treatment. That is just not acceptable. The people in America, they will find that unacceptable. We have, for a million people, 38 MRIs per million. Canada, 18. Great Britain, 9 per million. People are getting better care here in America than they are under these national health care systems. I can use the example of my mother. 56 years old, she has a heart attack. 5 years later, diagnosed with lung cancer. Extremely expensive treatments. You know, granted, she had health insurance. She was a teacher. She had some of the best health care around, some of the best health insurance around. Then she had a recurrence of the lung cancer 2 years later. I do not see any way that the national health care system that we're proposing for this country is going to cover her after a second round. I just don't see it. Some people say, well, a lot of this is fighting with the insurance companies. If you don't think you're going to be fighting with government for certain treatments, I don't know what to say to you. I don't even see that as being a possibility, that you're not going to have to go to bat for your family for treatments. I see people fighting with school districts all the time for treatments for their kids. You're trying to tell me that somehow by making this a nationalized system, we're not going to have these same kind of problems? Pretty much everybody that was here earlier and spoke was under some type of national health insurance, whether it be Medicare or Medicaid or the VA. Somebody was speaking, they were in the military. I would imagine they were under the VA health care plan. If we can't run those systems well, I don't understand how expanding it out to the rest of the country is a smart move. Why don't we fix those systems? In 2050, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are going to be the entire federal budget. That's it. That's all the money we have is going to go towards those three things. I don't see how this is going to be cheaper. People keep bringing up administrative costs. No one has explained to me how moving a seventh of the U.S. economy, which is a tax-paying organization, one-seventh, and moving it to be an expenditure by the federal government is going to be helpful. My suggestion to you is if you think that's a great idea, then why don't we do it right now? We just make hospitals, health insurance companies, doctors' offices, make them tax-exempt. They no longer have to pay taxes. Prices will go down because they'll no longer have that 40% that they have to pay right now. I don't think there's a single person in this room or in Congress that would say, yeah, let's do that. That's a great idea. Lastly, I just think this comes really from a freedom aspect. I know a lot of the people in this room, and they have said things for decades like, keep government out of off our, their hands off our bodies. It's our right. Our bodies are our most precious thing, and government should stay out of it. Government should stay out of our bedrooms. And yet those self-same people are up here saying, yes, we should turn over our bodies to national health care. We think that's a good idea. I'm sorry, I just do not see it that way. I see this as just a threat to, frankly, treatments that I just don't see the government approving, because I've seen them rejected in other countries, whereas they said, we're not doing that treatment. And people had to go to fight against the government, which will be just as difficult as fighting against an insurance company.
I have five other speakers, and I'm really hesitating to call on anyone. This is becoming a debate on national health care, not on a resolution to reaffirm support. I'd like to keep people, I'd ask people to keep their comments very concise and move to a vote. I have Frank, Carol, Nathan, Dooley. I would like to call on you to see if you can deal with your last resolve, and then Martha. Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Putting aside the fact, and I appreciate Dooley's remark about not having brought it through committee, I just want to draw your attention to a couple of things. And one of them certainly is it seems to be that we're hearing more and more that profit is a dirty word, and it really isn't. It pays for a lot of stuff, including contributions, donations, and whatnot. It goes without saying that a lot of people that spoke earlier from the public, and a lot of us also, can relate to a number of concerns, and our current system, regardless of what it is, isn't perfect. It really isn't. And there are people who have had to go without care. We heard some of those stories this evening. I can tell you very candidly that my mother-in-law...
Frank, could we please keep it concise? I do not want a litany of personal stories or more data from the Internet that you're all researching while the other person is speaking. I'm asking everyone to keep their comments concise.
Regarding the Canadian health care system, which she avails herself of, is not perfect either, because we heard a comment about that. But in with regard to a couple of items that are within the resolution.
Thank you.
The reference in, I can't tell you which resolve it is, it's the fourth resolve from the bottom, from the end, which talks about insurance company profits, CEO salaries, lobbying, etc. If you really, and the last part of that says that this will only cost us about 3 cents of every dollar. We heard an individual tonight refer to if we can send a letter for 42 or 43 cents, we ought to be supporting this. If you think the Postal Department is run efficiently, then you should jump right on this. That's why UPS and FedEx are so doing so well, by the way. And by the way, the Postal Department is thinking about cutting out Saturday delivery, and also they're about $2 billion in the hole, the last number that I heard. Secondly, in the body of the resolution, the first resolve refers to the legislature strongly supports. I think we ought to make sure that, regardless of what version of this probably passes, that we enumerate that if this passes unanimously, we ought to say it unanimously passes the legislature. If it does not, I think it ought to say that it ought to be explicit about how many people in the legislature support, in our county legislature support this. Because very honestly, there's not everyone in the county that supports the type of program that's being put forth here. I won't give you a lot of other anecdotal information, and I hope you won't call on anyone that's already spoken, because some of us are trying to be brief as well. The third and final item, and while I respect Dr. Tyler, who I think has left now, which is sad, I think some of the comments that we heard about doctors and the healthcare system taking advantage I think that's unfair to the healthcare system and also to our medical professionals. Not all of the medical profession are profit-oriented or grabbing at every straw. Some of it truly is administrative, and there's a problem with that. So let's fix that. This does not fix that. And I come back to my comment about 3 cents of every dollar. If you really think the government is going to be able to do this cheaply, you must be smoking something. Excuse me for being, and it's not my pipe. I really have hesitation about that. I really do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Frank. Carol Chalk.
Yeah, I just have three fairly quick points, I think, that I want to make. One was to speak to the question of process, because several people have spoken about that. And I didn't come in with strong feelings if the overwhelming sentiment were to spend the time to send this back to committee, that would have been okay with me. I do, though, on matters like this, believe that we benefit by having a group discussion with all of us being able to be part of it rather than a smaller group in committee. And as one of the two of us who came in midterm, I'm often told when I ask to spend time reviewing what's been done before, that I'm spending time on what's already been done. And as I researched this one, my understanding is that when this same body, before I came in midterm, talked about health care before, that it did go to committee at that point. And so there was an opportunity for this to go through the committee structure. And so for that reason, I believe that we should just go ahead and weigh in tonight. I did want to just stress the ability that what we're talking about here with a single payer system and national health care on a national level is basic health insurance, and this would not supplant the ability of the private insurers to come in with supplemental policies, and I do believe that would preserve both the best of being able to cover everybody at a basic level, and for those who want all the and want to pay for all the bells and whistles and fancy newest treatments, that ability would still be there, and also the savings. Whether you agree with the 30% figure and the 3% figure, we're talking about an order of magnitude of 10 times the cost that now goes to administrative costs that could be hiring more people into the healthcare system to actually provide the care. And then I wanted to weigh in on the notion of whether we should be spending time here tonight and offering a compromise resolution to the federal government. And I do believe that this is a point that there are times to compromise if we're working on our own resolutions, that there is a time to compromise, but on this issue there's a time to express what we really believe in our heart of hearts is best for the nation. On this one, at this time, I believe that there's been enough compromise. There's been enough talk of compromise. And that if those of us in Tompkins County aren't among the voices to say single payer, that would be best. That would make such a new system work best, that offering a compromise at this point offers too many excuses to then for the federal government to compromise on the compromise on the compromise. And so I would like to see us say, this is where we stand. We believe in single payer. So I hope that we don't fine-tune it.
I'm going to ask Dooley to see if you're going to be changing your wording of the last resolved.
I was actually next. Week.
I know you're next. I'm not calling on you yet, Nathan.
Dooley. I would like to, but may I publicly consult with Will? Do you feel strongly that we need to keep that last resolve about a public option?
I do not.
So I would be inclined to remove this, and I would do that. You want me to describe again how I'd like to do it?
Yes.
If you would look at the last resolved, the first line, the second line, and the third line, the words beginning with escape the inside the beltway mindset, and go down to the end of the parentheses, a self-fulfilling prophecy, and move those words up into the second resolved third line after the words for a new public approach, comma, and then these words would get inserted, and it would end, and take the opportunity to accomplish this major and long-needed reform. That will remove a reference to public option.
Could you read that, the final resolve then?
Resolve further that we urge Congress to waste no more time tinkering with the present failing profit-based insurance system, but instead seize this moment of health care crisis, recognize the widespread support for a new public approach, escape the inside beltway mindset that major reform is politically infeasible, a self-fulfilling prophecy, and take the opportunity to accomplish this major and long-needed reform.
Does everyone understand the wording change? I think, is it friendly to the seconder? Who was the seconder way back when? I think Will was. Is it friendly to you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mike, I just wanted to point out that there was a typo in the revised version. When we referenced the National Act, it in our revised version, it says the National Act.
Yeah, Health Care Act. And last resolve should have an L in it. Nathan Shinagawa.
Thank you.
I had all poll numbers too that would have directly countered everything that Mike said, but I won't say them. I just wanted to say though that that what's missing out of this whole healthcare debate right now, I mean, is this. We're talking a lot about how we'll pay for care, but we're not hearing too much discussion about what that care will look like. And I think that there is a lot of agreement amongst Democrats and Republicans on that. And I think that in the future, the legislature, this is something that we could do. We could have a resolution that talks about the importance of having EMRs and electronic medical record systems, about having better collaboration between primary care physicians and specialists, about having reducing the amount of hospital infections and that happen in hospitals that equate to about the same as a 747 crashing every single day. That's how many people die because of totally preventable hospital infections. I mean, these are all things that the structure of how you would develop the care is, I think, something that we really need to start talking about nationally. And I think that local community hospitals and physicians and people like us could actually contribute greatly to that discussion. And hopefully that discussion will happen soon. That's all.
I would really prefer to proceed to a vote. I have Martha very briefly and Mike Sigler very briefly.
And I appreciate that because I had a long speech before. In the second whereas, Dooley has written about the bankruptcies, 62.1% of all bankruptcies were linked to medical bills or illness. I would point out that it's been documented that 75% of those were people who had health insurance. And about rationing, I would say that we do have rationing right now, rationing based on wealth.
And Mike Sigler, briefly.
I just want to, I hope you're not referring to the New York Times, CBS, but we'll go into that later. I would like to offer an amendment. It reads, I don't know if it'll be friendly or not, we'll find out. Whereas single payer should be fair to all, Congress, the executive branch, federal workers, and union workers are not exempted from this, as is currently being suggested by Congress.
Is that whereas?
I guess it would be. Sure.
Okay. Is that friendly, Dooley?
Well, no, mainly because I don't know that it's true.
Okay.
That people are being exempted.
It's not being accepted as friendly. Is there someone who wants to second Mike's language? Frank Proto seconds. Mike, can you read it again?
Sure. Whereas single-payer health care should be fair to all, Congress, the executive branch, federal workers, and union workers are not exempted from this as is currently being suggested by Congress. I can lose the "is currently being suggested by Congress" because then...
This is exactly proving the point of why things need to go through committee. It has been seconded. Debate on what Michael has proposed as an amended language. Is there debate? I'm ready to go to a vote on the amended language.
I'll just comment on it that if it's national single payer, you don't exempt anybody. So I just don't find that.
Well, I don't know why Congress is suggesting they do it.
Because you're not talking about single payer.
Are you ready to vote on Michael's amended whereas?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All in favor of the amended language in the being added to the resolution? One, two, three. And opposed? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. 10. That fails. 3 to 10. Back to what was the revised resolution with a slight now.
I'd like to call the question on the main resolution.
The question has been called. Is there a second? Less than being Claiborne. That is not debatable. All in favor of moving to a vote?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? All in favor of the now revised resolution H.
May we have a roll call?
Sure.
Ms. Mackesy?
Yes.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
Mr. Proto?
No.
Ms. Robertson?
Yes.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Yes.
Mr. Sigler?
No.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Ms. Chop?
Yes.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Mr. Hattery?
No.
Ms. Herrera?
Absolutely yes.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Klinkelaer?
Yes.
10 ayes, 3 noes.
That passes. We also have another member file resolution. Aye.
Mike, I will withdraw that.
It is withdrawn. Thank you very much. We have a resolution that was two resolutions that were taken off of our consent. They were C and D relating to the Ithaca Tompkins Regional Airport. I'm going to ask Chair of our Facilities Infrastructure Committee, Leslie McBean Claiborne, to move those.
Resolution C, authorizing a 5-year extension to the Air Service Board at the Tompkins Regional Airport. I so move.
Is there a second? Captain Luce Herrera seconds. Is there discussion?
And I'm moving to revise.
This is pulled by?
I pulled it.
Okay.
And I pulled it because as I reread it sitting here, I realized that the first resolve may not really make correct sense. It says we are extending it for 5 years, but because there is another whereas that has been added pointing out that we had extended it till May 31st, 2009, what we're really doing now is extending it from May 31st to December 31st, which is not exactly 5 years. So I think we would be clearer if we took out is hereby the 4 or 5 years and just said is hereby is extended from
until December
May
31st.
To December 31st.
Until December 31st.
That's the period when it starts.
Is that language friendly?
Or just until December.
Until December 31st, 2013, that's fine with me.
Okay. And Kathleen Luce-Herrera, that's friendly? Okay. Everyone has the amended language. Are ready to vote? All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? That's unanimous. On to Resolution D.
Authorizing a consultant agreement with CNS Engineers Incorporated to conduct a 20-year green master plan at the Tompkins Regional Airport. I so move.
Is there a second? Julie Kiefer seconds, and someone pulled this as well. Mike Hattery.
I asked that to be pulled. This is a relatively large amount of money, even though the county's contribution is small. I'd just like to know what the nature of this master plan study is going to be like.
Bob, do you want to speak to it or Leslie?
To Bob? I can.
Well, it's been a long meeting so far. I don't know how much time you have to discuss the makeup of a master plan. But it's basically looking at where we are now, what's going to happen in the next 20 years, making provision for any kind of construction during that period of time, looking at how that construction will affect the environment and how we pay for it. That's the basic master plan. That on its own is usually around $200,000. This one is a special green master plan or a sustainable master plan, which will look at all those things from the point of view of how we can do it in the most environmentally friendly way, looking at the way the airport operates and trying to do everything to reduce our carbon footprint over the next 20 years. Possibly down to, you know, some airports are talking about coming up with zero carbon emissions within that kind of time frame. So there's a great deal of study involved in just the sustainability elements, and I think that's why it's going to cost that much money.
Follow up, Mike?
Will there be any pre-engineering work as a part of this master plan?
No, I don't think so.
Thank you.
Frank Proto.
Bob, some of us remember participating in that 1996 report. Is there going to be an opportunity for any board member to contribute to that, or at least sit in on these discussions?
Absolutely, yes. There will be many meetings involving stakeholders. If you have a desire to be involved in it, Frank, I'm sure we'll be delighted to have you.
I'm sure I still have that report, Bob. Thank you.
Pam Mackesy.
I just want to clarify something. Are you saying that this plan is just going to be focused on the green aspect or developing green cost savings, or is it going to be a total master plan that it has a green element to it?
It'll be a total master plan with emphasis on sustainability.
Okay, thank you. Right.
I think we're ready to vote. Is that accurate?
Wait,
yes. Dooley Kiefer.
I'll respect.
Excuse me. Dooley Kiefer.
I would like to suggest that the title of the resolution not say to conduct a plan, but to develop a plan, and that the first whereas would be changed to read whereas an airport master plan was last developed in 1966, and the components that were outlined in the plan have been substantially complete. I think those are clearer words.
That's fine.
It's okay with you, Kathy, as a seconder, friendly? I think I saw Carol Chalk's hand.
That's
okay. I think we're ready to go to a vote. All in favor of Resolution D with those small changes?
Aye.
Is anyone opposed? That's unanimous. We have to take a small break to change tapes. I will encourage you to be back in the room in 3 minutes.
Should we call on this?
Thank you.